This BBC podcast is supported by ads outside the UK.
This advertisement feature is paid and presented by Go Türkiye. Istanbul takes food seriously, very seriously. And meyhane restaurants are where it all comes to life. These traditional establishments are all about community, shared plates, loud conversations, and ruckus served as part of the ritual. But take a small detour and the food starts doing something different. As innovators in the kitchen, like Chef Deniz, continue to rewrite the menu.
In Istanbul, new young chefs like me develop the Turkish cuisine, but we don't replace tradition. We give it new life.
Because in Istanbul, food never stands still.
Old flavors, new ideas.
It evolves. Slowly, confidently, one plate at a time. Plan your next detour at goturkiye.com today.
Hello, Greg Jenner here. I'm the host of You're Dead to Me, the BBC comedy show that takes history seriously. Every episode, I pair up a top historian with a fantastic comedian, and we have a lovely, funny, fascinating chat about a different subject from world history. And in this new series, we're beginning with an epic voyage through the story of Homer, the Iliad, and the Odyssey. And that's with Kyle Smith-Bino joining us. And then we'll be learning about Francis Galton and the racist, discredited pseudoscience of eugenics with Desiree Birch. We'll meet many medieval saints in their bone boxes with Rachel Parris. So, if that sounds like your sort of thing, listen to You're Dead to Me wherever you get your podcasts. Thank you. Bye.
BBC Sounds. Music, radio, podcasts.
In the words of the Chinese saying, we are cursed to live in interesting times, a moment when the risks of global conflict, largely frozen for half a century, seem greater than in most of our lifetimes. To assess those risks, the Briefing Room is broadcasting a series of programmes examining each of three of the most likely arenas of conflict and asking, what are the chances of a conflagration in each? Last week, we focused on growing tensions in the Middle East, and next week we'll be looking at the European border of Russia, where Putin's Ukrainian adventure could spill over into neighbouring countries, members of NATO. But today we're focusing on the South China Sea, a heavily contested part of the world where there's renewed talk of a possible Chinese invasion of the island of Taiwan. Just how dangerous is the area becoming? Step inside the Briefing Room and together we'll find out. First, a geography and history lesson. Rupert Wingfield Hayes is BBC Asia correspondent based in Taipei. Rupert Wingfield Hayes, for those that don't know, can you tell them where Taiwan is actually geographically?
So Taiwan lies about 110 nautical miles off the southeast coast of China, and it lies also sort of along an archipelago of islands stretching from the Japanese archipelago to the north of Taiwan, and going all the way down to the Philippine archipelago off the southern. So it sort of sits in between these two very large archipelagos, the Japanese and the Philippines.
And the archipelago that you're talking about, that's the archipelago which is all situated in what we call the South China Sea.
Well, it sort of stretches from the South China Sea to the East China Sea, really, because Japan is really in the East China Sea, the Philippines is in the South China Sea, and Taiwan is sort of in between. And that makes it, of course, part of what is often called the first island chain that sort of stretches like a bit of a belt around China just off the Chinese coast.
Right. Now, how many people live on Taiwan?
It's about 23.5 million at the moment. So it's a fairly crowded place because much of the island is very rugged, very mountainous. The area from here where I am in Taipei all the way down the west coast to the big port city of Kaohsiung is very, very densely populated. And if you take the train down, you'll feel like it's sort of, you don't really get out into much open countryside the whole way down. But if you go to the other side of the island, it's completely different.
Right. And what's the economy based on?
The economic growth of Taiwan was really based on light industry, starting in the 1960s with textiles, but then moving very rapidly out of textiles into all sorts of plastic goods and then on into electronics. And I would say the dominant industries of Taiwan today, the ones that Taiwan are famous for, is microprocessors, particularly these very, very high-end semiconductors made by companies like Taiwan Semiconductor, but also electronic companies like Foxconn that make iPhones and laptops and things like that. Many of those goods are made in China, but the companies are based here, and it is Taiwan IP, and it is Taiwan companies that control that.
So essentially, they took a punt, and they got it absolutely right. Now, before we come on to the question of Taiwan's status and its relationship with China, can we just look at the other territorial disputes in the area?
Well, they are many. China has territorial disputes with many of its neighbours. So if you go to the north, there is a dispute with Japan over a small group of islands called the Senkaku Islands in Japan, but known as the Diaoyu in China. There's obviously Taiwan. If you go to the south, the whole of the South China Sea is deeply disputed. China has disputes with the Philippines, with Indonesia, with Vietnam, and even with Malaysia. But the most heated disputes at the moment are over reefs and islets that are disputed between China and the Philippines and China and Vietnam.
Now, why are these reefs and islets so important? I mean, why can't they just sort of easily settle, you have this reef and we'll have that islet?
Part of it, I think, is emotional and historical. China is asserting itself as the preeminent power in this region, as it was for the best part of two millennia. It lost that status to Europeans during the 19th century, in what is called in China the century of humiliation. And China seems determined to regain all of those territories that it feels like it lost. And that includes, it says, historical control over the South China Sea. The other motivation is resources. There is believed to be hydrocarbons beneath the seabed of the South China Sea. There are also very large marine resources that China needs to feed itself, and it wants to be able to control large-scale marine resources that it's very dependent on. And then there's the fact that much of China's trade, both in natural resources, oil and other minerals coming into China, and also goods going out of China, have to pass through the South China Sea. So, you know, strategically, it is very, very important to China to be able to dominate that region.
Now, let's talk about Taiwan, Rupert. Why does China think it has a claim over Taiwan?
Well, it says its claim to Taiwan goes back to historic times, that it has controlled Taiwan since early times. Again, it is not backed up by facts. If you go back to the 17th century, for a time, it was partly controlled by the Dutch. It was then claimed by China, but it was a very loose claim. China's political control over Taiwan only really solidified in the second half of the 19th century. And that was largely in response to the fact that Japan was moving south and had annexed Okinawa. And China suddenly realized, well, we don't really have control of Taiwan. We'd better take control. And so finally, in 1885, it was declared a province and the governor was appointed. But only 10 years later, China lost the first Sino-Japanese war to the Japanese, and Taiwan was handed over as war booty to the Japanese Empire and remained under Japanese control until 1945. So although China says that it has controlled Taiwan for a very long time, actually its control over most of its history has been pretty loose.
Now, so China took back, presumably, Taiwan after the Japanese were defeated in the Second World War, I imagine.
So at the end of the Second World War, under the Cairo Declaration, Taiwan was handed, control was handed over to the government of the Republic of China. Then 4 years later, when Chiang Kai-shek was defeated by Mao Zedong and his communists, his whole government and somewhere between 500,000 and 1 million of his troops and camp followers crossed the Taiwan Strait and set up a refuge here in Taiwan and declared it was the Republic of China on Taiwan, and has constitutionally has remained so ever since, although Taiwan has gone through, you know, significant democratic change in the last 30 years. It was Chiang Kai-shek retreating here in 1949 that sort of set up the anomalous situation that we are now in.
Now, let's look at what the international legal position of Taiwan is now. What does the UN say and what do other international legal bodies say about who has claim to Taiwan and who does not?
I think 1971, a resolution was passed by the United Nations to remove the Chinese seat in the United Nations from Taiwan and to hand it to China. And a vote was taken to do that. Now, if you talk to legal experts, they will say, and I have recently spoken to legal experts about this, they'll say this did not say anything about the status of Taiwan. It only determined the status of China's seat in the United Nations. So it is widely debated over what Taiwan's status is in the United Nations. It is not recognized as a member of the United Nations or as an observer in the United Nations. And so China is the sole representative of the people of China in the United Nations. And China says that that includes the people of Taiwan. The government here in Taiwan absolutely disputes that and says that it should be represented in international bodies, as are other, you know, non-state actors. And in fact, Taiwan has a much better claim to be represented in international bodies than organizations, for example, like the Palestinian Authority, that does have observer status in the United Nations.
Right. So it's in an anomalous position, which is it's not recognized as a country in itself, but it's not formally recognized by the United Nations as being part of China. Is that right?
The fact is, Taiwan is the Republic of China, as it is formally known, is recognized by 12 countries. It has still has 12 remaining countries that have full diplomatic relations with Taiwan. All the other countries that have switched relations to China over the years have done so with varying definitions of what Taiwan's status is. So, for example, the United States, perhaps the most important country in this respect, has said that it acknowledges China's position on Taiwan, but it does not agree with it. And so it has said that any resolution of the situation between Taiwan and China has to be done with the mutual agreement of the people of the two sides and without the use of force. So again, it's been left very vague as to what Taiwan's status, legal status, actually is, but that status should not be changed by force and without the agreement of people here in Taiwan. The United States' position is also that Taiwan should not move towards independence without the agreement of China. So it is keeping the status quo as it is today. Taiwan is not, as America views it, an independent country, nor is it part of the People's Republic of China. Its status is ambiguous, but it is a self-ruled democratic society with with fairly clear boundaries and its own military and its own foreign policy and its own foreign relations. So trying to define this is very complex because, you know, it is very vague and everybody is dancing around the fact that Taiwan in many ways looks like a country, it behaves like a country, it has all the attributes of a country, but it's not recognized as a country except by this very, very small group of very small nations, largely in the Caribbean and the Pacific.
Rupert Wingfield Hayes. Now I want to talk about the risks of escalation and what shape that escalation might take. Joining me are Amanda Shao, Crisis Group's Senior Analyst for China, Dr. Lauren Dickey, Taiwan analyst at the China Power Project at the Centre for Strategic and International Studies, and Shashank Joshi, the defence editor of The Economist. Amanda Shao, historically the orthodoxy has been, and in fact it was said on this programme 4 years ago when we last did this, that despite all the rhetoric, China won't actually invade Taiwan. Now, why has that been the orthodoxy?
Well, I would say that there's two key reasons for that. And let me just outline both of them very quickly. First, on the political side, the US and China have always disagreed over Taiwan's status and its sovereignty, but they reached a loose set of understandings that undergirded a fragile peace that really lasted for decades, in which the two sides essentially said, we're willing to paper over those differences. You know, China seemed more concerned with deterring Taiwan from declaring formal independence. And even when it was trying to move the ball forward on its objective, which it calls unification, you know, it signaled that it was willing to do so primarily through peaceful means. And Washington was willing to keep its relationship with Taiwan unofficial and under a certain threshold and to not take a side on the differences across the strait. And on the military side of the equation, there was really more cost than reward for China. You know, China still significantly lagged behind the US in terms of military capabilities, and there was always the question of whether Washington would intervene directly if China launched an attack on Taiwan.
Lauren, does it follow that the Chinese have simply not been wanting to pay the costs that would come with an invasion of Taiwan, that their calculation has been that it's simply not worth it up until now?
I certainly think that sort of the costs of an invasion of Taiwan is one factor that the Chinese government has considered for some time. But I also think that they've had to look very closely at their own military capabilities and the qualitative and quantitative advantages that they have both vis-a-vis Taiwan, the U.S., as well as other regional and global U.S. allies and partners. And China has had to weigh sort of all of these factors alongside one another. The point I'd make here is, you know, amphibious invasions are very, very, very hard, as we've seen historically. And I think that holds true to this day. But where we see, you know, this orthodoxy perhaps changing and the conversation shifting globally is that China's capabilities have narrowed that gap, right? At one point in time, whereas Taiwan maintained a quantitative and qualitative edge, we're talking decades ago, that has now shifted. And China very much maintains a qualitative and quantitative edge over Taiwan. I think that increases the risk that China uses military force to pursue its political goals, but it may not necessarily mean that this risk is something that we see happening tomorrow.
Shashank, do you think that the inhibition has been mostly political or mostly military?
I think it's been both, because I think that the Chinese leadership surely realizes that if they fail to accomplish the goals of any invasion or other military operation, and it doesn't need to be a conventional invasion, that would have politically existential risks for the Chinese Communist Party. And so I think that that's figured very, very prominently. But I think both those factors make a difference. For instance, it makes a difference as to whether the People's Liberation Army is ready for this kind of operation. But the global situation also makes a difference. I think it makes a difference, for example, as to how occupied and absorbed America is in Europe, what's going on in the Middle East, how many military resources is the United States able to devote to the Indo-Pacific region, and what's happening in China itself, both in the short term, but also in the long term, in terms of the state of its economy, its demographics, and how does that shape a Chinese decision to invade now versus doing so in 10 or 15 years?
Okay, so let's look at the question of why it is that the Chinese might calculate that now or roundabout now might be the time to take action. Amanda, what might impel China to this form of action?
Well, to underscore, I think also what the other speakers are saying, you know, I don't think that the calculus is that China will take action in the near term. The costs still remain higher and more certain than the rewards, which remain relatively uncertain. But nevertheless, tensions are rising and the risks are growing. There are a number of reasons for this. One, China is stronger today. The Chinese military can now impose much greater costs on the U.S. military should the U.S. decide to militarily intervene in response to a Chinese attack. Secondly, the Chinese leadership's decision-making has become more risk-tolerant and assertive in its sovereignty disputes just more generally, right? So we're seeing that it's willing to escalate its actions in those disputes as a means of defending and advancing its claims. So we see that in the South China Sea, along its disputed border with India, and around Taiwan, where China has significantly increased its military activities. There are Chinese military planes flying around Taiwan every day. I'd say just on the calculus part, the Chinese leadership has, on Taiwan specifically, also just shown itself to be more eager to show progress towards unification, right? And the way that it's managed that cross-strait dynamic has become more domineering. It's showing that it's caring less about what Taiwan thinks and its people thinks about unification. And it increasingly shows that it believes it can strong arm the island into accepting its terms. So those are some of the reasons why there's increasing concerns about China's calculus.
Lauren, part of that is China, in a sense, getting itself into a rhetorical position whereby in some ways it seems easier to push ahead with aggressive action than it might have done in the past.
Yeah, so I think it's very clear, you know, China has not renounced any intent to use military force towards Taiwan. And I think they have a full sort of ladder of different tools that they can use from day to day to sort of this high-end, most dangerous conflict scenario we're talking about. And I do think that China is more eagerly employing some of these tools on the lower end of this ladder, because to Amanda's point just now, they see the trends changing. Whereas prior Taiwan administrations had been willing to find some sort of political middle ground and use terms that matter to Beijing, specifically the 1992 consensus, you see current President William Lai on Taiwan very much moving away from all of that. And while he has extended, you know, an open hand, as it were, to China to open up trade and tourist flows and things that sort of underwrite the socioeconomic ties between the two sides, that does not seem to be something that China is interested in right now. And rather than having these sort of quiet communication channels or informal connectivity, you see China tightening and clenching really just around this notion that Taiwan is becoming more Taiwanese in one sense of the word, and sort of more entrenched in its own distinct identity as Taiwan. And so I think those trend lines for Xi and for the Communist Party are probably worrying. You couple that with the uncertainty in the U.S. around elections here and sort of the outlook under a future administration. And certainly Xi is looking at all of these alongside his own preparedness to consider, you know, is there a right time? Again, I'll say I don't think it's now, but I think these are all factors that he's certainly considering.
Shashank, one of the considerations which has been mentioned here has been, if you like, China's military capability. And the suggestion is its capability is greater than it was, and therefore its lack of capability is less of an inhibition.
Its capability gap has narrowed considerably. On any metric, you look at where Taiwan and China were 20 years ago versus where they are now. It's night and day. But I think against that, you have to remember the scale of the operation. Lauren alluded to this earlier on. The Taiwan Strait is over 100 miles wide. We're talking about one of the biggest amphibious operations in recent history, in modern history. There's one study that estimated logistically, even if you could invade, you would then need to get across 3,000 military trains. You need 1 million vehicles, 8,000 ships. You'd need 30 million tons of material to be moved across, which, to put this in context, is significantly more ships, vehicles and supplies than America and its allies used in the D-Day landings. And so all of this has to be done by an army that has not fought a major conflict, or really any kind of serious conflict, since the late 1970s. And that experience is lacking. So yes, the gap has narrowed, but I think it's doubtful as to whether it's narrowed enough to allow a traditional invasion that would succeed in conquering the island.
Okay, let's suppose, however, that we're wrong about this, as some analysts were wrong in October 2021 about whether or not Putin would go into Ukraine, and a military conflict does develop and China does decide to take the island back by force. Shashank, can you talk us through how that might develop if it were to happen?
Well, first of all, I think it's important to say there's growing interest in forms of aggression short of conflict. The most obvious one of those is a blockade of the waters around Taiwan. And the appeal of that, of course, is that it doesn't require an amphibious landing, and it puts the onus of escalation onto the United States and other parties who have to break that blockade and sustain life on this island, whose main ports are on the west side within range of Chinese missiles, many, many more Chinese missiles than the other side. And so that's number one. Other options would be, for example, an attempt at decapitating the political leadership in Taiwan, assassinating the president, or conducting sort of raid to seize key facilities. But if we mean a full-scale invasion, then of course the assumption, I think the two key assumptions are, first of all, it would be accompanied by, probably preceded by, a significant period of missile and airstrikes. And China has a very sizable arsenal of conventional missiles, and the island is within range of most of those. And secondly, is really the point that this would be visible for a while beforehand. This is a huge strategic build-up. We would see highly anomalous changes in troop movements, port movements, the movement of ships. I think it is basically impossible that China could achieve strategic surprise. And so as it unfolds, I think we'd have a great deal of notice in order to prepare and respond for outside states.
Lauren, what do you think?
So I agree with a lot of what Shashank just said. This would be an extraordinarily intricate military operation across all domains. So it's the air, land, and sea power, as well as electronic and cyber warfare. It would be nothing like what we've seen in modern warfare, and frankly, nothing like what we've seen from China, as they've had to wage much lower scale conflicts on their periphery in recent years. I think I would also emphasize, too, just the catastrophic consequences of the war. There have been some studies done publicly that estimate the costs of this conflict, this high-end invasion scenario that was just described, could be up to $10 trillion or 10% of global GDP. So this is far outpacing anything we've seen in Russia, Ukraine, or even the Middle East. And everyone, really everywhere, would be feeling the effects of this conflict in some form. But I would probably disagree slightly in the challenges of observing some of this conflict and the movement of troops and all these things. You know, there's a lot of great resources that track this, as we've seen again with Russia, Ukraine, but particularly with some of the lower forms of aggression, the blockade or a quarantine. There's a lot of, I think, movement of vessels or assets and people that can be done under the auspices of one type of activity and potentially used for another. So I do worry. What keeps me up at night is that there is some risk of surprise, and it's certainly something that policymakers need to continue to monitor.
Amanda.
Yeah, I mean, I think to echo what everyone else has said, this would be an extremely complicated operation. But perhaps just to talk a little bit about how uncertain the reward remains. So both spoke to some of the costs that China would have to bear. But just to really underscore, you know, Taiwan is composed of mountainous terrain. It sits across a body of water from China. Its geography is rather defensible, and even given its military disadvantages. And, you know, even if the Chinese military makes it across the water and successfully establishes a foothold in Taiwan, there is a lot of uncertainties around how the Taiwanese population would respond, how long they would hold out, and essentially how quickly the Chinese would be able to compel compliance from both the government and the people. And so there's a lot of uncertainties around whether China can even achieve its goal that it sets out to do.
From everything you three have said, it would seem that the most likely way in which this would begin is with the blockade that Shashank mentioned earlier. If there were to be such a blockade, Lauren, how would other countries in the region and how would the United States respond?
Yeah, at least for the United States, current law and policy sets out a couple of requirements for us. And the U.S. is unique in that we have the Taiwan Relations Act. Other countries, the United Kingdom included, have no similar law. So for us, at least, the Taiwan Relations Act stipulates that we have to provide Taiwan with defensive arms and services, that we have to maintain the U.S. capacity to resist coercion that could jeopardize Taiwan's security. And third, that if or when there is something that is a threat to Taiwan's security, that the President of the United States has to inform Congress, as well as any threat that could impact U.S. interests by extension of implicating Taiwan. So it's pretty broad, and I think that that is necessarily so, because what it would mean, you know, whether it's blockade or invasion, is it really does give the president, Congress, and the American people sort of the space to navigate a decision and decide what an appropriate response might entail. I think with a situation that impacts the global economy on the scope and scale that this could, there would be pressure by all sides and by more than just the United States, I'd hope, to de-escalate quickly. We are seeing some indications of how other countries are sort of broadening in their not just awareness of these risks, but also their concerns. I'd point to statements by the G7, as well as countless other bilateral and multilateral statements by governments in the region and beyond, expressing concern about China's coercion of Taiwan. But then I think we would probably also see some actions and immediate reactions from the neighborhood, right? So Japan is obviously in closest geographic proximity, the Philippines as well. And you see changes by both partners in their own force posture, how they train, and really how they're preparing overall to better reflect and adapt this changing threat environment and potential future risks.
Shashank, since you raised this question of the blockade and the question about what you do about it, in the first instance, of course, you try and say persuade the Chinese to stop it. But if you fail, what can you actually physically do about it?
Well, there's a number of options. One of them, for instance, is that if you may not be able to break a blockade of Taiwan, but what you can attempt to do is impose what we might call a counter blockade, and that would be a distant blockade. So, for example, you stop Chinese-bound ships at choke points like the Strait of Hormuz in the Middle East, the Strait of Malacca in Southeast Asia, and you can stop a decent chunk of merchant vessels that are sending vital goods and products to China. The papers I've read on the subject suggest this would be a pretty serious undertaking. It would take many weeks to put into effect. You would need to sustain it for about 6 months to cause any shortages of civilian or military goods in China. And China has, of course, been stockpiling commodities and other goods in the last 12 months. And it would rely on the cooperation not just of the countries that Lauren just mentioned, but also on all of those countries which sit astride those choke points. That's Indonesia, Malaysia, Papua New Guinea, Singapore. You'd have to use their ports, their airfields, their waters. And you'd also have to deal with the fact that modern shipping is very international. So, you know, what do you do if a ship is carrying goods to China, but it's crewed by Indian officers, it's flagged by a European country? So there's all sorts of challenges. But I think a counter blockade to try to choke off China's economy and cause it pain and squeeze it is one of the options that you would have in response.
Shashank, let's move beyond Taiwan to the concerns about what's happening between China and some of the other countries in the region. We talked about Japan, we also talked about the Philippines. Are there any dangers of escalation there?
Well, there are many flashpoints. And right now, the situation in the South China Sea between China and the Philippines is reasonably high among them. What we've been seeing is that the Philippines has been resupplying a sort of territory that is disputed, that China claims as its own. And in the process of doing so, it has intimidated, sometimes in very dramatic and violent fashion, the Philippines vessels reinforcing that. So, for example, we've seen ramming of Philippines vessels, the forcible boarding. This is an area called Second Thomas Shoal. But we've also seen water cannoning. And I think what this tells us is twofold. One of them is that steadily, China has been using more and more aggressive tactics across the region to pursue its political objectives, using the manipulation of risk to get its way. And we've seen that not just in Taiwan with more air and naval activity, but also elsewhere in the South China Sea. And I think it also tells us the tactics that China is using are also liable to lead to a crisis. And water cannoning Philippines vessels isn't the only example of this. We've also seen the use of sonar against Australian divers. We've seen the use of chaff thrown in the pathway of jets in the area. A number of very unprofessional, very violent encounters. These have gone down between the US and China since Xi Jinping met Joe Biden last year, but they're still continuing in other ways. And I think the aim is both to intimidate and I think to test the boundaries of these countries' strategic relationship with America, to say, let's see how far we can push these things, to see when America steps in or how far America leaves us to it. So I think this is really a contest of wills to some degree that we're seeing play out in the Philippines. And it is of a kind of the activity we see around Taiwan and elsewhere as well.
Amanda, how far is China prepared to go in intimidating its neighbours in order to try and get its way in these areas?
Yeah, that's a very good question that I'm not sure that we have a totally concrete and satisfactory answer to that. Let me just say this. As Shashank was pointing out, there is certainly greater tolerance for these risky, risk-creating escalatory activities. Because in China's calculus now, that risk, in their view, actually paradoxically creates more stability in terms of their interests, right? Their calculation is, if I create more risk in this situation, I will be able to deter my adversary and intimidate them from moving closer to my red line, right? And so they're trying to shape the range of options of the other side by cutting off some at the what they see as the more provocative end of the end of the spectrum. Now, where does that end? We have seen some indications, even though we are dealing with a more assertive Beijing, that they are, in fact, not interested in escalating to the point of war, and certainly not escalating to the point of war with the U.S., right? With the Philippines, just very recently, China has struck at least what seems to be a tentative agreement and understanding in terms of their interactions at sea and the Filipino resupply of this ship on a disputed shoal. So there is some indications that when China does see things spiraling out of control and getting out of hand, that it is willing to take the steps to de-escalate and to lower the temperature. I think the question here is China always aware of when and when exactly it needs to step in to de-escalate?
Right. Let's suppose there is an escalation. And let's suppose that the White House is occupied by somebody who wants to take a fairly kind of robust line against it. Lauren, obviously China has a seat on the Security Council. The Security Council is not going to vote for measures against it. So who are the international interlocutors who can help try and defuse the situation?
I think we can expect, with recent history as our guide, that China will be very quick to court its own allies and partners globally. We've seen this in recent flare-ups as well. Typically, China will reach out to its partners in the global south, as broadly defined, in hopes of convincing them, first and foremost, of the merits of China's own narrative, and really leveraging in most instances, China will be very quick to use the press outlets in these countries
Which countries are we talking about?
I would highlight sort of South Asia in parts, as well as Africa, a couple of aligned countries in Europe as well. You know, one might look where Xi Jinping has gone on recent travels as just one indicator of places where they feel they might have a little more political sway. Places in Europe like Hungary, and Serbia in particular, where you see, and these are actually great case studies in countries that are hedging, right? They're managing relations with the EU and the United States, but also taking actions that are in what they believe to be their own strategic interests by deepening ties with China, as well as in many cases, Russia. I think in that regard too, you could also expect a strong vote of support with whatever China is doing from Moscow. Obviously a deep historic relationship there, and you've seen the extent of that partnership really playing out in Ukraine as well. And I think Russia would very much have China's back in any crisis or conflict, whether that's rhetorically or through other forms of assistance.
Shashank, I'm scarred by the fact that back in October 2021, the consensus was that Putin wouldn't go into Ukraine. A calculation which was changed pretty rapidly, long before the invasion, actually, but nevertheless had to be changed. Should I be worried at all that our kind of idea that it's unlikely that this will happen is going to be shattered in the near future by a miscalculation or a different calculation by the Chinese government?
I would say two things, David. One of them is that look at the concatenation of different factors across the globe. And recently, the British Army chief talked about sympathetic detonations between different crises. If you have a world in which Ukraine's lines are collapsing, Europe is at risk, in which Iran is pursuing a nuclear weapon, there's a regional war in the Middle East, it seems not unreasonable to posit that China may see more opportunities, more distraction among its adversaries, a greater prospect of success than otherwise. So it really matters what else is happening in the world, I think. And I think the second thing to remember is that in early 2022, I did come to the conclusion that Russia would invade. And it wasn't because I thought Russia would be successful. In fact, I thought the opposite. I thought it would be a catastrophic occupation that would be a quagmire for the Russians, though I didn't anticipate the details. And the lesson I take from that is that countries don't always go to war because they feel they are sure of success. They can sometimes go to war because they judge it is more advantageous to do so now than it is in 5 years or 10 years. In other words, they see closing windows of opportunity. And that dynamic was operative in World War I in places, and it's been operative at other times in history. So I think it's really crucial as we look at the world through the eyes of Xi Jinping and the Politburo and the CCP, that we don't just ask, do they think they can win? But do they think they are likelier to get a good outcome now than they would in another 10 years when things may work out far worse?
My thanks to Shashank Joshi, Amanda Shao, and Lauren Dickey. And in the final podcast of this three-part mini-series, our focus will be on Russia and a possible conflict with NATO. That will be available at the same time next week. You've been listening to The Briefing Room with me, David Aronovich. The producers were Ben Carter, Kirsty Knight and Drew Hindman. The editor was Richard Varden and the sound engineer was Rod Farker.
In December 1969, Muriel Mackay vanished from her London home.
We have your wife. It will cost you £1 million to get her back.
Two men targeting Rupert Murdoch's wife, Anna, had abducted Muriel by mistake. It was the first high-profile kidnapping in British history, and the tabloid press were hooked.
You know, was she alive? Was she dead?
The police were baffled.
It's the most hideous crime, kidnapping. It's worse than just a straight murder.
And Muriel's family was thrown into a nightmare that continues to this day.
I just want to find my mother's body.
I'm Jane McSorley, and this is Intrigue, Worse Than Murder. Listen on BBC Sounds.
Hello, Greg Jenner here. I'm the host of You're Dead to Me, the BBC comedy show that takes history seriously. Every episode, I pair up a top historian with a fantastic comedian, and we have a lovely, funny, fascinating chat about a different subject from world history. And in this new series, we're beginning with an epic voyage through the story of Homer, the Iliad, and the Odyssey. And that's with Kyle Smith-Bino joining us. And then we'll be learning about Francis Galton and the racist, discredited pseudoscience of eugenics with Desiree Birch. We'll meet many medieval saints in their bone boxes with Rachel Parrott. So if that sounds like your sort of thing, listen to You're Dead to Me wherever you get your podcasts. Thank you. Bye.